but also to introduce to you Liz Verhage. Liz and I have become vast friends over the last 6 or 7 years. I first met her in Washington, D.C. at a meeting. I was chairing Covenant World Relief, and we were meeting in Washington, D.C. for a meeting of Call to Renewal and Bread for the World. And there before us was about 40 of younger clergy in the covenant who were just absolutely spectacular. Each one of them so very called, each one of them so very, very gifted, Liz being one of those. And then Liz came to Seattle and she consulted in the mercy, compassion, and justice area with us for 4 years. And we started a homeless shelter for women. We started and continued on a feeding program for teenage runaways. We started this and that, and she was all part of that. But the most beautiful thing was that Liz was Liz, and she was such a wonderful friend, a person who you want at home. And so when it came to preaching today, I wanted you to experience my good friend Liz. I invite her to come now and to share the word with us.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you for inviting me to share this day with you. I'm very excited for the meaning that this day holds for your congregation and for my good friends, Mark and Robin. Join with me as I pray. Gracious God, we know that you are already here and already at work. May the words from my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be pleasing and acceptable and point to you, O God. Amen. Last week, I was at a symposium at North Park Seminary, and it was discussing the venerable topic of money and possessions in the church. And near the end of the event, after many good papers and a few not so good, we heard a sermon from a United Methodist bishop in northern Alabama, someone you may have heard of, named Will Williman. And among the many things I learned that morning from Will Williman's sermon, I realized I had never sat in North Park's chapel as a student or afterward and witnessed such laughter. It erupted and it came out at surprising times. And I kept coming back to one thought as I sat there listening to him preach. This man keeps telling the truth. Williman told us truth about himself, about how much he made his salary each year, and what he tithed. He told us the truth about how money is connected to self-deceit, even to lust. He told us the truth about the poor and about Jesus. And I think part of what happened as we sat in that small chapel was we were caught off guard. That much truth unfolded and pulled back and exposed. We laughed at the surprise of it. So I suppose I'm blaming a well-known preacher for a well-done sermon in some ways here, because I have been stuck with that thought all week. What is that power behind telling the truth? And I know in many ways this is a simple, even a childlike concept. My daughter Eva, who's just 3 years old, she's learning this concept. She understands, at least in part. She came to me once when I was working in our office, and she announced, "Mama, I'm going to go get into some trouble. You just stay here and type." Now, before you judge my husband or I on our parenting, notice that she did tell us first. And yes, I stopped typing and I went and checked out what her trouble was. But this confession makes me wonder, how many times do I do this with God? Do I ever let him know, "I'm headed somewhere I really shouldn't. Just go about your business"? Do I do that with those in my life that I'm most accountable to? Am I even honest enough with myself to know when I'm headed for trouble? And here's where we get a little deeper, right? We pull back this veil, we look under those easy answers, and we're touching on some uncomfortableness with truth. Because after all, telling the truth is costly work. And it's also a revolutionary act, and I'm convinced it's one the church must keep in front of us to be church. The alternative is of course, if we don't tell the truth to each other, we have many, many variations or semblances of truth that will try to take that place in our world. There are stories in this world constantly telling us who we are and who God is, who we're to worship, and who we are in the world. I want us to examine this reality today together, that we are gathered here as the church in order to proclaim the true story about who we are and who God is. And I know that telling the truth sets us free. The burning bush story that we retold today is a well-known one. In fact, it's kind of the archetype, right? It's the first story of calling a prophetic leader in the whole scripture. After God calls Moses this way, this call to being a prophetic voice will be echoed. It comes up in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Jonah, even when Gabriel visits Mary. God calls Moses to be the leader of an entire people who have been enslaved. He asks Moses to walk into this impressive, exemplary role. Moses, as we know, doesn't see himself that way. He's been wandering. He's a bit lost. He's been between countries, between ethnic realities of being Hebrew and Egyptian. He gets caught up in tangles like oppression, violence, murder even, and nationalism. In this passage, we now find Moses quietly wrapped in the shawl of a shepherd, holding his crook on the side of a deserted hill. He's currently in an interracial marriage, employed by his father-in-law, running from his past, hiding from a whole lot of truth. As with many biblical heroes on paper, Moses doesn't have a particularly strong resume. Moses even calls himself earlier in chapter 2, "I'm an alien, I'm residing in a foreign land," because as this wanderer who's between, he's never really been at home anywhere. He's never had a reliable people or a community identity. But this is all part of the beauty, part of the point, isn't it? Even a lost, murderous Hebrew, a shepherd shrouded on a hill, can become the leader of an entire people. And after being filled with the heat of the burning bush, he couldn't turn away. Even this one trapped in worry about being up to the task, even one who sees certain failure in his future, even one who's being asked really an absurd vision of freeing an entire people group, he gives 4 objections, and he asks the wry question, well, if they ask, who do I say is bringing the real muscle? After all this, he can respond to God with a yes, but not out of his own identity or his own lostness, but acutely aware of God's fiery power of who God is. So a central part of this truth that we proclaim when we gather and when we are church is that it is not all about us. Faith and formation and the ministry of being the church, it's really not just about our individual lives, neither our successes nor our failures. In other words, it's not up to us to perfect our own faith, nor can we ever wander so far or get so lost that we can truly mess things up. The good news is that we are part of this story. We're invited into it, but we're not main characters. None of us, not even Moses. We're each in this story because at one point in our lives, God's grace called. We noticed a strange, a wild, a consuming fire. Maybe it was in the consistent witness of faith from our parents or friends. Maybe it was in the water of baptism. But we experienced this beauty of who God is. The holiness of God does that, don't you think? It pulls off our cloaks, our coverings. It pushes us to go deeper, to focus on a vision that's so much bigger and so much outside of who we are. The truth is that who we are is much less important than who God is. And telling this truth sets us free to be the church, to admit we need each other, and then to welcome the world to this good news. When I first met Mark, as he mentioned, he'd asked me to come out and talk with their church in Seattle about how to do compassion and justice and have a biblical framework. And I love doing this kind of work, so I said yes. And I was leading a series of workshops on how to know your community and know your congregation and think through doing ministry. And we were talking about how the early church was full of those kind of people. It was full of converts who were on the margins of society. The poor, the enslaved, women, those who were lost and didn't fit other places. And I will never forget one question. That day, a hand near the back shot up. And with some considerable passion, a young man named Tim asked me, "Well, where did all those early converts go? Why aren't there more people like me here in the church today?" Tim, you see, was a formerly homeless young adult, and he had recently been connected to the church through an outreach program. And I think what he was really asking was, how come no one else here seems to know that they need help as much as I do? Why does everyone act like they have it together? And this is not just a reality in any one church. This is part of the story of when we gather. We tend to do that. Later on, Tim and I talked more about how maybe the church could look more like Alcoholics Anonymous if it were healthy, where at the beginning of every meeting, individuals stand up and they name their weakness. They name dependency on God and on each other. The world is telling us false stories every day. We may hear that our primary role is to be consumers. We may hear that we are self-sufficient. You are in control. You can put off death and suffering. You can manage your future. We may hear that our worth depends on our economics. It depends on the color of our skin, our age, our gender, our education. The world might tell us that out in the real world, the way things are really done by grown-ups, it's okay to serve mammon. It's okay to let a political party dictate your speech. It's okay to take human life casually. The world even is pretending, even today, that drastic famine in the Horn of Africa is acceptable, that children and women can be bought and sold in sexual slavery around the world. But the truth is what sets us free. We gather to proclaim we know what's really going on. We pull back the shroud. We expose those lies. And we learn together in our dependence on one another how to live in that chaos and how to build each other up for this hard vocation of being in this world but not of it. It's hard to figure out fact from fiction, knowing what voices to listen to. And I'm convinced that one of the most influential voices from the world right now is the false gospel of individualism. It's this idea that ultimately each of us is only accountable to ourselves, that it's okay to go get the most for me and mine first. Many theologians argue that the number one lie in the world that is a challenge to the Western evangelical church we are a part of is this gospel of individualism. It's an overly privatized faith, and it's one where the church can feel like a market, where God can seem like an ATM. But we know this is cheap grace. We know that this can result in us settling for only being politically correct or continuing to segregate ourselves like the world does. And it weakens us on a deep level to believe this lie because it avoids the truth that we are not finally in control. That grieving and confessing and forgiveness must happen in community with one another. Ultimately, individualism avoids the wildness of that burning bush, the messy work of relationships. But the truth shall set us free. Thankfully, the truth is that no, it's not about us, because God called a people, an entire race, a priesthood. In 1 Peter, we hear again that the early church was given peoplehood. They were a nation. And this would have sounded scandalous. Remember early first century Christians, Jews and Gentiles, they were still duking it out over whether or not circumcision, a distinctly ethnic practice, had to happen on new Gentile converts in order to be Christian. But Christ preached something offensive, that all who believed belonged to this new peoplehood. And notice, all these plurals, all these metaphors, they're plural. There's a race, a nation, a priesthood, a people. There's a repeated willingness to connect over boundaries that the world has drawn. First Peter is changing the categories around. It's turning the question on its head of where we find our belonging. Instead of Moses wandering between countries or a minority new young church who's being persecuted under a different political power, here we hear, Christ followers, you belong. You are at home in the house of God. You are connected to each other like parts of a body, interdependent, even though you're unique. Now, I confess that at times, this gospel of individualism, it gets to me too. I love crossing off to-do lists. I love being productive. I love changing and improving and moving ahead. And frankly, other people slow that down. More often than it is attractive to admit, I have caught myself thinking, if all of you would get on board, we could really get some stuff done here. We could be the church if you would understand where I'm coming from, go with my opinions, and just move already. In my mind, we could probably repair the fractures in the global church, welcome people searching, fix poverty, conquer multicultural leadership issues, end the worship wars, and give fair trade coffee to every church in the covenant in about a week. Of course, you see, I have some blinders, and they're profound. My tendency to race ahead and to strive, it's a gift and it's a strength, but it's a weakness if I'm untethered from a community, if I'm not connected and accountable to enfleshed real relationships. I read something by Scott McKnight where he was saying that evangelism in the church today is more like a slow cooker than a microwave. And I wonder, how often do I try to kind of zap that reality, make it what it should be, when maybe it's just starting to simmer? But the truth is what sets us free. And this truth that we offer each other and the world, it's both this challenge and this hopeful message. We proclaim, your fate is not up to you, you overachievers. Neither can those of you who are painfully aware of your need and your brokenness. You can never wander so far that you can't encounter the burning bush again. We are all free to bring all of who we are to be shaped by this community. We all get our identity from God's grace. Today, North Park Covenant, you are entering a new season, building on 113 years of faithfully retelling this true story. From being fresh-faced immigrants to wrestling with language and ethnic changes to having the world at your doorsteps, you are a people. You're a community that's been defined by God's identity. And like living stones, these walls have held leaders and pastors, faithful men and women over the years, who put their trust, as Moses did, in who God is. You've been a revolutionary force. You've been telling people week after week who they truly are and who God truly is. And many in the wider covenant family thank you for your stewardship of many over the years. I personally thank you because I was baptized by one of the voices shaped in this community, Doug Cedarleaf. His tendency to tell the truth is, of course, the stuff of legend. And I've also had the privilege of working with another prophetic voice in Mark. I was lucky enough to get to know both Mark and Robin, and I received many gifts from them already. They have profound hospitality and wisdom and compassion. They give attention to deep relationships. They have a strength of convictions, and they love food and having fun. I've learned much from your new pastor already, and I'm confident that God will continue to shape him, and you will too. This is a Moses-like leader attuned to glimpses of burning bushes in everyday life. He works hard to intentionally tell the truth about his story, to make space for others to do the same. Together, God will let you have the freedom to both celebrate and grieve, to ask questions, to share dreams, to care for each other, and to rest in that long, slow, rewarding work of building deep relationships. I'm so hopeful to see how his call to this church and your call to be church will build each other up during this next season of ministry. So hear this truth today, people of God. When we gather together, what we are doing is not separate from the rest of life. It is a revolutionary act. We are like subversives. We're scampering up the side of a hill. We are like salt. We are like light. We're uncovering, we're unfurling the banner that sometimes is hidden, and we wave it high. He is risen. Life and death and suffering, they have meaning. We know the true story. We know we're not alone, and we know we need each other. God's grace is sufficient, and we who once were no people, we are a people. Church, before any of our programs get planned and our schedules take us away into the business of life, remember that we gather here to tell the truth and to be the truth to each other. And that truth is what sets us free. Amen.